Welcome to the Atwell Podcast.
Mr. Ackley, welcome to the Atwell Podcast. I really appreciate you coming on. And if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of your background and your story, and we can sort of go from there.
That sounds great. I appreciate the time being a guest with you today. Some of my background may be similar to some of yours. I was born and raised in a little town in eastern Ohio called Zanesville, Ohio. And it's one of those old rustic towns, you know, a lot of coal mines and steel mills and things like that. It's probably about about an hour from Wheeling, West Virginia, right on Interstate 70. Okay. So part of the, I guess you'd call it Central West Appalachia. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up there. My mother, I have two siblings, two older siblings. My mother and father were divorced when I was about, I think, almost three, two or three in that area. And mm-hmm. so I never really grew up with a father that was in the home, and I'd see him, you know, every now and then. But generally it was my mother and myself and my two siblings. And so we grew up, you know, pretty poor, not like a lot of people experience poor, but you know, we were poor. We were looking for gas money and how do we get around town with the bus systems and things like that. And, you know, growing up without a dad around, you know, really started to materialize the detriments of that really started to materialize when I was kind of in my teenage years, my early teens, and then through when I graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of not a happy growing up, but it wasn't, you know, we just stuck together and made do with what we had. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I was in high school or during my high school years, you know, just not having a lot of interaction with men in general, mm-hmm. you know, I lacked a lot of confidence. Tons of confidence mm-hmm. that I just lacked. You know, I'd be in high school and seeing, you know, football team and, you know, the members of the football team and so on. And I didn't fit in, to be quite honest. I had very few friends. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, when I was a senior in high school, it was the realization for me. And I wasn't very smart back then, but at least mm-hmm. I had this notion that was pretty smart, and it was, I need to be disciplined. I need to find out how to be disciplined more. I need to be able to develop confidence and so on. And so I joined the military. I was in the enlisted in when I was a senior in high school, and I went to Air Force basic training and Air Force technical school. And I, you know, so I did that for about 6 months or so altogether. And then I ended up being in the Ohio Air National Guard for a total of 12 years. Mm-hmm. And it was very helpful to me to gain all of those attributes that I was trying to gain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, during that time as a senior in high school, I met a fellow classmate, who is now my wife. We originally met in the seventh grade, and we didn't date or anything, but we just said hi in the hall, mm-hmm. you know, through high school. And then right at the graduation of high school, we went out on our first date, and she came from a much more well-to-do family very stable. Mom and dad, great. Mm-hmm. And she caused me to raise my bar, you know, that I have to be more than I am. Mm-hmm. And we're still together today. And it's been 41 years, and I have five
Wow.
children and eight grandchildren, and I'm speaking to you from my home office. I have a couple offices, but my home office here is in Salt Lake City, Utah. And yeah, been here for gosh, 11 years, a little over 11 years. And it's been a crazy ride going from where I was as a kid to being really poor and to where I am today. And I even wrote a book about it, Randy, where I originally wrote it for my children and grandchildren, but it's really how did I do that? How did I go from an poor Appalachian kid with no dad and around much to where I am today? And it was an it, when I put all my notes together, my journals that I kept, I went through everything. It was quite the journey, but I was able to pinpoint certain things that happened to get me out of where I was and build my life on that to where it is today. So that's a lot of, Randy, that's a lot of words. So I'll
Yeah, you're okay. I
pause
got a
there.
lot of questions.
Yeah.
So the first thing that sort of pops out to me is obviously your relation to whaling. Excuse me. So let me ask you this: how close is that? Is that anywhere close to Point Pleasant, West Virginia?
I'm not sure. I
Yeah,
am
I
not
know that
sure. You're
there's
talking.
a border with Ohio and there's obviously a lot of border between Ohio and West Virginia,
Yeah.
but I've been there, so I was just sort of guessing. So you
Yeah,
went through.
you go through St. Clairsville. I know one of the cities on the way to Wheeling, West Virginia, right on 70, St. Clairsville, Ohio. So
You was talking about how you grew up in a divorced family.
yeah.
So obviously divorce rates are incredibly high today. And obviously you must have took that to heart because you and your wife have been together 41 years. I mean, that's awesome. First of all, that's a beautiful story. I really love
Yeah.
it.
I'm very proud of that, by
I
the
would
way.
be too. I
Yeah.
mean, my wife and I have been together since she was in high school, so 14 years. I'm
Yeah.
33, and there's not many around us that's got us beat, you know.
Yeah, I understand.
So in relation to your other classmates, how many of your other classmates was dealing with divorce as well? Do you know if their families were split apart?
I don't think very many. I'm just trying to think off the top of my the friends that I had, the close friends that I had, they, their mom and dad were married. I'd go visit them, and one particular friend I'd go over quite a bit, and the dad would come home and the mom would come home with, a car full of groceries. And I remember helping them bring the groceries into their house and thinking, oh my gosh, I've never seen this amount of food before.
No.
But the life was different for me than the friends that I had. Now I'm sure where, there were a lot of divorced families around in the neighborhoods and things. I just didn't, I just weren't acquainted with them. But, the most of the friends that I had and the people I knew in high school, came from stable marriages and so on. So I felt a bit out of sorts, kind of not fitting in. That lack of confidence. I think fathers provide a lot of confidence in their kids growing up, especially in their teenage years. And it was just a piece for me that was missing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree a lot. And I think that the father figure being the more disciplinary figure, helps create that confidence.
Yeah.
And you got to have structured discipline when you're growing up. I have two boys, two sons, 10 and 12 years old, and they're good kids, but they know what to expect from me, and
Yeah,
they know
that's
what to
right.
expect from their mother, you know, and we
Yeah.
work good together. So
That's great. Yeah.
when you're talking about food, one thing that kind of sticks out to me is that I'm old enough to remember when food stamps was coupon books. So,
Yep.
and it looked like Monopoly money. And
All right. Yep.
So Dr. Ruby Payne, she was talking to me a few weeks ago, and she was telling me, she said, well, Randy, she said that the lower class really, really take, I'm losing my words I want to use. The lower class focus more on quantity, whether the middle class focus on quality and the high class focus on presentation when it comes to food. So it sounds like to me that the area that you were in, that you had some middle class friends, but it seemed like you were even below that poverty line, not even really in lower class.
There was there were times I remember quick story for you. I was in the seventh grade and my mother worked all the time. She worked at department stores most of her life, so she was hard of hearing, and so she had a hard time finding a job that was that she could do and with her hearing issues. But she got a job at a in Zanesville at a department store at the time was called Buckeye Mart. She worked there for years, many years. So she did what she could. She worked very hard. She was on the issue of food. She was a very proud woman. And by that, I mean that she did not want to go to the government and get food stamps. I remember her going to the place and saying, look, can I just get like 2 weeks worth? And then so I can get some food for myself and my kids, I just need these, maybe once a year, a couple weeks, we'll struggle by. But she fell short, and they wanted her to quit her job and just go on, government assistance at the time. And I remember this, and she didn't want to do that, so she said, no, I'm not doing that. And so, there's a double-edged sword. I understand her pride. I'm very, she wanted to do it on her own. She wanted to take care of her family. And at the same time, she didn't want any help from anybody. And that caused us to be many times without food. So back to my story, in the seventh grade, we were, our cupboards were empty. There was nothing in the refrigerator. And it was probably the worst it had been before and after. But in that, in that sixth, seventh, and eighth grade time frame was very difficult. And one day, my mother's brother, who she hadn't seen in, oh gosh, I want to say 20 years, 25 years. She hadn't seen him. For some reason, he came to visit her in Zanesville. He lived in Columbus. And, he walked in the door and looked at how we were living and just said, what happened here? And then my mother told him the story. He didn't know she had been divorced for, many years. And he immediately took her to the grocery store. And I remember that and filled up our cupboards with food like I had never seen. And maybe you identify with this, but I still to this day, the relief that I felt for basic things, food, gas, he put gas in the car that she had. And it's people that lack basic things. It's the small things that provide comfort. And you're right, it was the quantity of food. We didn't get any of this, quality of food. We were talking macaroni and cheese and oatmeal and butter and bread and things like that, which gave me so much comfort because I didn't have to worry about it for a while. But another long-winded answer for you regarding that subject.
No, you're okay. So on food, I have a really dramatic story which I'll share with you. I haven't actually shared this before. I haven't had so much focus on food before, and I'm glad that it came up. So we lived in a van for about a year and a half, five of us, my dad, my mom, and all three of us. And my dad would hand out tracts. So tracts were religious pamphlets, think comic books, little square comic books of religious literature. So we went from West Virginia to Texas, living in a van for a year and a half, stopping at parsonages, which is church-owned properties, and basically begging our way from state to state and then handing out religious literature. How this relates to food, I remember this vividly. I was probably 9, 10 years old, so very not in that teenagehood where it was going to probably scar me from life, but definitely old enough to remember the emotions that you're feeling. We would get 12 packs of glazed donuts. I swear on everything I love, 12 packs of glazed donuts. We would eat on that for days, just one pack. And to this day, I'm 33. To this day, I do not like donuts. I do not like the smell of them. I don't. But the situation with us as it relates to poverty. So my dad came from generational poverty. And nobody had been through college. Nobody had graduated high school. I think he had one brother who did graduate and he got out of Dodge. He said, I'm, this is not normal. I'm leaving. So he wasn't a help to the rest of his brothers. So he goes through generational poverty. My mother, her dad was a Vietnam vet who got Agent Orange. So she ended up dealing with a lot of health complications, including a brain tumor at a very young age, think 18. And she's still living. But what that did was is it put us on Social Security disability. My dad didn't work, so that's what all five of us lived on when we were stable. So the food stamps and stuff really helped. My dad would usually work maybe a month out of the year just to get like an earned income tax credit or something like that, just to get some taxes back at the end of the year. That would usually pay for late payments and, fees that we were late on throughout the year. And I understand this now, but what it did for me was, is it put me into a situation to get a job really young. So at 12 years old, I didn't have school clothes. Well, I go and start mucking stalls at a local horse farm, so I could get some clothes so I didn't look like an idiot in middle school,
I get it.
The thing that surprises me, and this is going to give us, I'm getting an alarm here, so you'll forgive me here. Oh, okay. Yeah. So my phone was just coming up and letting me know that we're still recording. So the thing that surprises me with Appalachian poverty, and I'll see how you feel about this. Towns are cut off. So, in other words, when you're living like in Ohio, like maybe not right on the Appalachian Mountains, but more northern Ohio, think closer to Michigan, it's flat, right? And if you lose your job in one town, the other town is 20 minutes down the road, probably has that job. There's more of an economy. Whereas in West Virginia, where we're cut off from the mountains, you lose your job here, you don't have another job opportunity in the same thing for an hour away.
I understand. That's right.
And to me, so I'll ask you this, and this will sort of correlate to your background in finance. How much do you think that geography plays into poverty?
I think it plays a pretty big role. It because if you're in an area like you just said, that's remote. Some of these small towns don't have a lot of industry in them. And if you are lucky enough to be in one of those industries, so for example, coal mining was a big part of my ancestors' background. Steel mills were as well, probably the same in West Virginia. As if a person loses a position in that, maybe it's the only good paying business in the town. If you lose that, then where do you go? How do you get there? You'd have to move your family. which a lot of people can't do. They don't have, the kind of finances to make those kinds of moves. So you kind of find yourself stuck in an area. And it's the risk, it's the added risk to life when you're in one of those areas where, the steel mill closed down or the coal mine closed down, and you have one skill set, and that was the only place in town. It adds a lot of risk and uncertainty in the family. And uncertainty, it's not good for children to grow up in. It's not good for the mom and dad. The stress that's added on to it. Then you get to the point where are there, the hopelessness feel and what that leads to. And so it's, one of the things that I discovered early on was I have to break this mold because my family was generational poverty as well. And I'll give you a couple stories here. And this ties back into the fatherhood and men in my life. So my father's father died in 1938 in a coal mine in eastern Ohio. He was one of these guys that went in, prepared the equipment. He was by himself. He'd go in early in the morning. He prepared the equipment for the first shift to come in. And he was doing that one day, and the cave-in killed him. And they discovered him when the first shift came in. So I wasn't even naturally, I wasn't even born. My father was 8 years old. So my father grew up without a father. My mother's father got this goes back to 1929. It was the day after Christmas, December, or I'm sorry, December 26th. Yeah, day after Christmas, December 26th of 1929. My grandfather on my mother's side died from double pneumonia because he was in the coal mines and he was sick, and but he had to keep working for his family. And so he died. My mother grew up in a foster home because her mother couldn't take care of the five kids, and she grew up in a foster home. So it's these situations that develop in generational poverty that at some point somebody has to call the time out and say, this has to end. And for me, it was, when I was like 18 years old, I knew my history. I was my brother and sister and I, we all graduated from high school. My brother and I went on to college and graduated from college. Nobody had done that in the past. My father quit school at in the 10th grade. And so that's the way it was in my part of the Appalachian experience, is was just generational, and you don't know any different. That was the frustrating part, is growing up, I didn't know any different except for those friends that I saw in high school that, they lived a better life. They had a little money. Nobody was rich, but they had, they were not struggling. And a big change for me was when I met, well, I met my wife, as I mentioned, in the 7th grade, but when I started to date her, it was an eye-opener. I took her on her first date, and I walked into her house. And this shakes me to this day. I walk into her house and there are pictures on the wall, paintings on the wall. My walls never had paintings. There was carpet. There was nice carpet on the floor. I never had nice carpet. There were things on the shelves, brass artworks and different things. And I stood there and I thought, I don't belong here. I almost walked out on that date. I remember standing there just, I do not belong here. This isn't me. I'm here and my wife's family is up here. And in my mind, it was, Jan, you have to stay at your level. That's what you were born to do. That's what my mother used to say. here's our lot in life, she used to say. And so that being around other people, as her father became a mentor to me. He was a dentist in town. And he taught me so many things that I had never thought of before. It just blew me away. And I thought, can I do this stuff? And he's, Jan, there's nothing stopping you from doing things like that, being successful. And it broke the generational poverty mindset that I had. And it was because I associated myself with people that had my best interest and that cared about me and wanted to show me a better path.
So I'm going to have like a bunch of stuff here that I want to touch base on. The first thing that pops up to me is relationships. It seems like that you had a mentor. Dr. Ruby Payne has tried to force that into my brain because I argued with her, right? I kept telling her, now imagine this, a kid from a trailer park in West Virginia arguing with the world-renowned expert on poverty. Needless to say, I didn't win. But she makes a good point. So I'll give you my argument for and against, right?
Yeah.
My argument was with her that relationships are only good because it gives you information on when you change classes. So for you, that would be the lower class to middle class, right?
Yeah.
So my thing was, now we have the internet, we can Google anything, we can learn. But she said, Randy, she said, you've literally got to change the way you look at information, and you're only going to do that with relationships and that peer pressure. So it seems like to me that you had, while your mother was a wonderful woman, it seemed like that there was some peer pressure there from her to stay on that same line that you were on, that generationally. And
yeah, she was, I think you're right. She was, it was because the peer pressure for her is because she didn't know herself.
Right.
My
right.
dad didn't know herself or himself. And it was this lack of understanding about the world, how the world works. And for me, Randy, it came in stages. This mentorship came in stages. And let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay.
When I was 17, I started going to church. I thought, man, I got to go to church. So I started going to church, and there were some really good men in the church that I went to. And my experience with men prior to that, number one, it was lacking. And it wasn't the best men, they just weren't the best men in general. I got a phone call from this guy from church, and he, kind of a funny story. He said to me, his name's Larry. And Larry said to me, Jan, I would like to stop by on Sunday after church, pick you up, and then we'll just go see some people. And man, my experience with men, I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I was a little scared, nervous, right? Men, going somebody with that I don't know. But he kept calling, and he was a nice guy. So finally one time he called, and I said, yeah, I'll go. And so I remember going into his, he had a truck, and he pulled in the front of the place I was living, and I opened the truck, and it smelled good. It smelled clean. And I remember looking down at the ashtray, and it had never been used. And it was, this was a gee whiz for me, a kind of a moment of emotion for me, because every car I had ever been in smelled completely like smoke. The ashtray was full and overflowing with cigarettes. And something in my head when I got in there said, okay, he's okay. Because I was used to chaos. Anytime I got into like my dad's car, if he picked us up for a visit or somebody else, there was chaos, chaos, chaos in life. Opening that door, getting in with him, it was peaceful. And I didn't know where we were going. I joke with my kids True. I thought, man, I don't know what I'm going to do for him. Am I going to go collect money for him? Some
Yeah,
come
really.
yosing money. It's the way my brain worked. And I asked him, what are we doing? He goes, we're just going to go help some people. And we drove to two families, and one was an elderly couple. We visited with them, asked them what they needed. Some of them need, or one family need a little food. So he was a hunter, and he delivered some deer meat to them. And then we went to another family and spoke with them. But then on the way home, something happened. And this is where the mentorship, the first stage came that I mentioned. And that is, he took me to an ice cream shop. And I didn't have a lot of ice cream or, back in at that point, but we sat there. And it occurred to me, I was 17 years old, and on that spot, we were sitting at a table eating ice cream. And it occurred to me, this is the first real conversation I've ever had with a man, with an adult man that cared about me. And he asked me things like, what do you want to do in life? And I said, I don't know. I never thought about it. And do you like to go hunting? Never been hunting in my life. Every question he asked me, it was like, I don't know. I don't know. But he kept on. And I said, I just don't have, I remember starting to tear up because nobody ever asked me these questions. And he, I just said, I don't have any confidence. And he said, Jan, you got to go and just do things and I'll help you. But he became a mentor to me of just basic man to man. Man to young man interaction I never had. And I thought this is, and he came from a, he had a wonderful family, took care of him.
That's
And
going to be my next question, is what his background was.
yeah, he was, it's interesting. He was a truck driver. He drove trucks all over the country, food and things around the country. He was a, or I should say, and he was a good man. He cared for, he had two boys, cared about them deeply, loved his wife deeply, and you could see it in everything that he did. Maybe a year later, another guy calls me from church. He was a one of the big businessman men in town, and he wanted to come see, like 18-year-old Jan, 17-year-old Jan, and he came into my house. And I thought, what does this wealthy, he was very wealthy, what does he want with a poor kid like me? He said, I just want to help you. Just want to help you. And he talked to me about business. He talked to me about jobs, things I had never thought about. That was the first stage. Second stage is I went into the military and I had some mean TIs in basic training. And the best thing that ever happened to me was those men in Air Force basic training that pushed me and made me uncomfortable, which is what I needed. And then
Oh,
my
yeah, they
father,
definitely will do that.
yeah, and then my father-in-law comes, which is kind of a third stage. You got the mentors, the Air Force, father-in-law being another mentor. And then I went to college and I had some pretty good professors. And that's where I started to see how other people lived that were going to college. And so for me, mentorship changed my life because it was so personal right there with me as I went along the ladder.
I'm gonna tell Ruby about you, because her big thing was she had one thing that she wanted me to agree to if to do a larger project with her. She said, Randy, she said, I want to focus more on spiritual things over the next 10 years and how it relates to getting people out of poverty. And for me, I'm graduating from a Christian college, Liberty University in May,
Oh, that's great.
as long as this corporate finance class don't. Anyways,
I'll help you with it.
Business 320, I hate it.
Yeah.
And the fact that you had mentorship right there from the church. Church historically has done some great things. There's some bad actors. There
Oh
has been bad actors. They get a lot of news, but the church used to do food pantries, and they used to reach out, and someone's house burned down, they'd be there with a check and clothes. And I was in those food pantries and in the clothes giveaways or the school supply lines, so I'm really happy that you mentioned that.
And Randy, I have there's on that subject, it turned out that, I really started going to church when I was 17. I joined the church when I was 16, but I didn't really go that much. But I remember when I was 16, it was in January, and we lived in a place that, oh, the heating, I mean, that was so inefficient heating. And one, it was in the, I think it was in the winter of 1979 in that area. I was a sophomore in high school, and the heating bill came in. It was over. I remember it being $300, but I think it was a little over $300. We couldn't pay it, and my mother couldn't pay it, and they were going to turn it off, turn the the gas off, and no heat in January in Ohio. And that, I think for weeks, it was hard to sleep. It was hard to think in school. It was like this weight on the shoulders of what in the heck are we gonna do? And it after a few weeks, my mother found out somebody had paid that bill.
Oh, gracious. That
Somebody
had to have been
paid that
someone
bill.
from church.
It was the bishop in the church that I was going to. They had a fund to help people like us. My mother would have never asked, but I think it was one of the guys that was visiting me, 16, 17 years old. Somebody in the church knew our situation, told the bishop. They paid that whole thing. And I was in English class in 10th grade. And the weight, it's interesting. When the pressure of the world is on a kid and even adults, it can be overwhelming. And I remember sitting in class, in English class, and I had my hand up like this because the weight, the emotion, the relief, I started to tear up, and I didn't want anybody to see me crying in the 10th grade in English class. And the teacher walks over to me, and she says, "Everything okay?" And she whispered it. She handled it very good. Is everything okay? And I said, "Yes, I've had this huge problem, and now it's gone, and I'm just so relieved." And she smiled at me and went back to teaching. But the lesson I learned there was empathy. Empathy for those who don't have, who feel that weight on their shoulders. And in many ways, God can help you. Religion can help you. And it's using the people in churches. God uses people in churches to look for people that need help. That happened to me. So religion plays a big part of it.
I really like that, and I really appreciate you being that open with it, because
Oh, yeah.
some people are scared to say that they had a positive experience with church because of the way the world is today.
Yeah.
And then you have bad actors. I have a meeting with a federal judge in April who was dropped off at a convent, and she was hurt in a number of ways that is just, I'm not even going to get into big
Oh,
details,
yeah.
but she was hurt in a number of ways. And she's actually an atheist, but she's a very nice lady, but it can go
Yeah.
a lot of different ways. And for me, the church has been really positive for the most part, and for my children.
Yes, it gives direction. For me, I'm speaking for myself. It helped me to lay some groundwork as I was calling a timeout and say, I got to get off of this old dusty road and up to the highway of life to figure things out. Church gave me a steady, God gave me a steadiness in my life that I needed at that time. So it, and I'm still very active religiously.
Awesome.
And it's just, it's been a game changer. It's been a life changer for me. But my experience has been good. You gotta be very in tune with and separate the good from the bad.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is that one person doesn't speak for all of any kind of demographic. If this podcast sucks, it's on me. You might find another podcast that's pretty good, right? I want to talk about the military and how that related, because I have a story that's kind of cool, kind of terrible and kind of cool. So talking about how that military gives you structure, it also gives you a lot of masculinity, right?
It did. It really did, Randy. And the thing that I mentioned early on as we began this conversation was my total lack of confidence. I mean, it was off the charts low. The military helped me gain confidence, which is part of the reason why I went in. I remember flying down to Lackland, all the Air Force guys and women that go into the Air Force, they go to basic training at one spot, Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. That's where I went. I hadn't been away from home that much, so I'd never been to Texas before. So we get down there hot as cra it was in July. It was hot, like on fire. And but I remember that in the bus that they had us in to take us from the airport to the base, going through the guard shack and the military policemen with they were just dressed to the T, right? They everything was perfect. And I remember in that bus saying, I want to be like them. I want to be put together. It was almost like a metaphor of life for me. I want to be put together. And that uniform for me was like the symbol of, okay, here you go. You're going to be like that. And then for the, I think basic training from my memory, been a long time ago, from my memory, 6 weeks, it still may be 6 weeks. During that 6 weeks, you get yelled at a lot and you go through multiple uniforms as you progress in basic training. And it was an incredible experience for me. I didn't like it at the time, but I knew I had to do it. One experience, one story I want to tell you from that from a confidence standpoint that sticks out for me, I was everybody had to perform what's called a dorm guard duty. So while you're, it's called a flight. There's like 54 guys or 52 guys in a flight, and they were all out training. One person had to stay behind and guard the dorm, right? And it was my turn to do that. And only certain people were allowed to be in there, but these high-ranking sergeants would pound on the door and want to come in, and that happened to me. And he saw something. I had this book that I was filling out. It was a military book that I was supposed to fill some stuff out. I hadn't caught up to where I was supposed to be in it. He came over and started looking through my book, and then he came over to me, and I was standing at attention. He put his brim of his Smokey the Bear hat right there. And he was yelling at me at the top of his lungs, spit going in my face. And I had to stand there and take it. It was the worst yelling in my entire life that I had ever gone through to this day.
Shark
And
attacks.
oh my gosh. But the reason I tell you that story is because when it was all over and he ended up leaving, I remember saying to myself, I did that. I got through that. I'm still alive. I mean, here I am. I absorbed that and I'm fine. And that was a mental moment for me that helped me build confidence. It's something that sticks out to this day as far as a confidence builder.
I'll share a story with you, and you'll probably like this, well, the later part of it. So, as I said before, my father had passed away when I was about 15. Well, that was in July. By January, roughly like 6 months later, I was shipped off to something called the Mountaineer Challenge Academy, which is a military school in Morgantown, West Virginia. So kind of northern, right, in January. So you live on military base for 6 months. You do your basic training while you're there. So you're going through all of that. Now think about this. I was 16. So you got a 16-year-old kid, been through poverty his whole life. His dad just passed away. My mom lost custody of all of us kids. So I know that when I get out of this military school, I'm going to end up, in an orphanage or whatever, more than likely. So as it relates to the shark attacks and things, nothing can give you more confidence than going through something terrible. And it was kind of almost, I would almost call it, I hate to sound like a liberal, but toxic masculinity, because you were just getting screamed at sometimes for no reason, And back then we still had the black boots that you had to shine. Everybody else after us had the brown, nice leather boots. They didn't
Yeah, I
have to
had the
shine
black
them.
ones. I
Dude, it
can
took
make those black boots shine, a little water, a cotton ball, and some, rubbing all day. Unbelievable what you can do with
I sucked at it so bad. There was some kids who could,
that.
they could do it. They could shine them so good that they could shave in these things. So, I'm mad and done with life. And you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you run, 5 miles, you're ready to puke, and they're like, "Well, that was warm up time for PT." And it's like 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And man, that sucked. That was 6 months of absolute crap. See, usually back then, I think it was basic. I want to say it was like 18 weeks, maybe, or
Wow, that's a
something.
long time. Yeah.
Or so, I think that was like with your school. I remember it's been so long ago, but I remember vividly that we were going to do the basic basically twice by living there for 6 months. So
Yeah.
you were basically there for double the time. So you're kind of getting it a little bit worse. But I think at the time, if you did it and you passed the program, you would start off like an E2 or E3 or something like that.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
I didn't go on to the military myself, but talking about a confidence builder,
Oh, yeah.
you're solid muscle, and you get out and you get into some of the civilian, I guess, places. And you're like, "Man, I don't care about this kid in Walmart giving me a dirty look." It's like, I'll knock him out easily,
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's so true what you say. With the benefit of a lens, as I like to call it, looking back, the struggles that I had, the path that I took, made me better today. Being going through adversity is very important. I don't think enough younger people allow themselves to go through adversity. Adversity is a very important part of preparing yourself when you're young to go out and take on the challenge of life in the world. And it was so beneficial for me, going through all of the stages that I went through to be able to do what I do. I talk to, I'm in corporate finance. I'm in my 36th year of it. I've talked to, some of these finance guys in New York, and they're different, right? They're very they can be very confrontational. It's their personality. And I talk to them like I can talk to somebody, down the road, but it's different. And being able to take that confrontation and realizing it's no big deal, right? It's going through my childhood, figuring out how to solve problems, critically think, and being able to withstand the pressures of life have been very beneficial to me.
Let's talk about your corporate finance background a little bit. Something that pops up into my mind is like, and I'm probably reaching here or assuming, I'm like, okay, this guy went through extreme poverty. So Did you get into corporate finance and do a business major because you wanted to understand the financial aspects of life more? Am I
Yeah,
right?
I mean, you basically summed it up. I'll give you the deep story is, when I was growing up, when I was a little kid, my mother had previously, before I was born, had worked in a as a teller at a bank. She did that for a couple of years, but she had, as I mentioned, hearing problems. So, that didn't last long because she couldn't hear people talking well, but she did work as a teller, loved it. So when I was young, she had a game that she played with me, and she called it Bank. Let's play Bank. So we cut up fake money, and out of cardboard, we built this little teller stand, right? And so she would be the customer, and I'd be the banker, and all that kind of stuff. She was very, it was interesting. She was very strict about how you, she called it how you make change or count change. Like if you give somebody gives you $10 and your total is $2.58, she was very strict about how you count that money back to the customer, the process. You don't see that anymore. But from a very early age, that, I always was fascinated with the kind of the money itself, because I didn't have any. How the world, and at the older I got, how does this whole money thing work in the world? And so when I went to college, I went to Ohio State, majored in finance, and got a bachelor's degree in it. And it was became even more interesting to me. And I went right to work. I moved my family to Detroit, started working for a large bank in Detroit, a great bank called Comerica Bank. They took care of me, and they put me in a training program right away that was like 8 weeks or something like that, like a basic training of finance. They took care of me. They trained me really well, and I've been doing this for 36 years, and I get calls from all over the country to help companies with their financing, and it's just been tremendous interest of mine over the years.
Is that more or less like, can you explain to me more about corporate finance? Because literally, I swear on everything I love, I'm doing a corporate finance class right now, Business 320. I hate it. I hate it because it's like super complicated accounting, or at least that's like what my class is. Like, can you explain like what corporate finance is like a
Sure
little bit?
thing. Well, yes, corporate finance, you're correct. It has a lot of accounting to it. So as I was getting my degree, excuse me. I had to take a ton of accounting classes and naturally a ton of finance. They're kind of brother and sister, accounting and finance. But corporate finance is all lending. It's lending to all sorts of companies, any size, from very large to kind of small. All companies need financing for some particular reason. Most
I see.
need lines of credit, right? These re we call them revolvers. They're revolving lines of credit that it provides a company, no matter what size, liquidity to operate their business. And then most companies, like manufacturing companies, distribution companies, they need equipment. And that equipment is not cheap, so they need financing for that. And then there's, there are really strong companies that are easy to do, and then there are companies that are very challenging. They have some weakness within their financial statements that need a lot more attention and work. And that's really where I focus my efforts is on. It's my efforts are on those companies that have some key weaknesses to it, but can be overcome. Kind of goes back to my thinking of being able to problem solve as a kid and things like that. That's where I focus on those companies. But the size of transactions can be 50 million all the way down to maybe a million. Just depends on the size of the company and what their need is. But there's a lot of analysis that goes into determining how you best serve those companies and if you can get it done.
Right. So I'm going to probably ask a bunch of questions with this. And the reason is because I love the stock market. I love business, right? I can sit there and listen to Milton Friedman for 7 hours. My wife will literally be over there ready to kill me. And that's fun to me. That's fun. So corporate finance. So you're not representing a bank. You're loaning, or are you working as an intermediary between the bank and the corporate business, or are you lending money from a corporate business to other businesses?
No,
If that
so
makes sense.
this is a great question. So I've done both. Most of my time has been in the banking world. I did up until, well, I'm gonna say, I spent about 4 years working on my own, being that intermediary between the bank and the company. I did that for 4 years, but I got a an offer to help grow a bank here in Salt Lake City, and that's what I do now. I'm the chief credit officer at this bank in Salt Lake City. But it's a good
Awesome.
question because when you're an intermediary, most intermediaries, consultants, if you will, they really need to be experienced in the industry because you will see companies that need a lot of help and banks that sometimes they don't understand exactly how to help a certain company. Maybe their skill set at the bank is such that it lacks a little bit of that of seniority in their lending ranks. So I speak both languages of, I barely speak English. I'm a hillbilly, right? But I speak the language of finance to banks, and I speak the language of finance to companies, and they're a little bit different, and you have to be able to work through both of those. Now, as like I say, I out of my 36 years, I've spent 32 years in banking, the last 20 years as an executive in banking. But as a banker, it's very important to understand the needs of that company. Typically, as a banker, there's occasionally I work with intermediaries, which is really good. I like doing that, but occasionally you get these companies that will reach out directly and say, "Hey, what do I do? I need this funding." So as a banker, you just go in and I do the same thing. I evaluate the situation with the company. There's a lot of travel to it. I travel around the United States visiting with companies. I've seen thousands of companies over 36 years. Any sort of company you can, industry you can name, I've done it. And so it's the level. It comes down to person to person. Almost like going back in time to when I was 17 years old at that ice cream store talking to Larry. It became a person to person. He cared about me. Banking and any, I think a lot of industries, jobs are like there should be like this, where it's people, it's understanding their problems and seeing if you can help them solve their problems and create some opportunities. And that's why I love it so much, is because of that interaction.
Yeah, so I'm gonna have obviously a bunch more questions because I'm extremely interested.
Please.
So I know you're probably like, man, who in God's earth is interested in corporate finance? You almost got
Oh
to
man,
be.
I love talking about this stuff, so I'm glad you're interested.
So probably gonna bore my listeners to death, but I can't help
Yeah.
it. It's just an opportunity that popped up out of nowhere. So when you're lending on behalf of the bank, so the bank is the one who's paying your salary, or is it the
Yes.
corporate? Okay,
Yeah,
so
I
that.
just I yeah, it's a job. Yeah, really, it's a career field. The bank, I work for the bank. Bank is in Salt Lake City. I work for them. and I get paid a salary from the
Yes, sir.
bank. And I have a team under me that helps me. We get a lot of transactions in every single day that have to be gone through and underwritten and understood. So yeah.
Yeah. So you're not a individual like consultant company. So if you're working for the bank, I guess one of the biggest questions that pops up in my mind when you're looking at a $50 million transaction, right? Are you're going by a special finance rate, like corporate rate? In other words, you're not going by the prime rate, are you? Like,
Yeah, there's in the banking business, there are various interest rates. One of them, where I don't hope I'm not getting too technical, but where the prime rate comes in, the prime rate is a floating rate. It'll float up and down. If a company has a 3-year term on their, let's call it a revolving line of credit, that revolver is going to fluctuate. Because of that, the interest rate needs to fluctuate as well. So
So it's a
prime is
variable
used.
rate.
It's a variable rate, and in the yeah, it's called variable. In my world, it's a fluctuating rate, variable rate. There are many terms for that. That's used on mostly lines of credit, mostly lines of credit, because the credit goes up and down. You borrow today, pay down tomorrow on a line of credit. Then there are other interest rates that are fixed rates. It's like your house. Typically people get a 30-year fixed rate on their house. In corporate finance, it's very similar, but the fixed rate is based on the exact term. If it's a term loan and it's 5 years, that fixed rate is based on a 5-year, and you go out into the market, into the financial markets, and you get the cost of funds to the bank. Now, banks have deposits that they use to loan, but they can also bring in like additional CDs, things like that. And if they match fund it, they'll bring a certificate of deposit, a 5-year, and it pays on that 5-year cost of funds. And then the bank adds a spread to that to quote out the term loan to the customer. It's different than a floating rate, but regardless, the bank watches its cost of funds, and then it's called match funding. On term debt, you match fund it, so there's no interest rate risk for the bank, right? So the you remember the bank that failed in California, I can't even remember a year or so. They weren't match funding. They had too much interest rate risk. So banks typically match fund. What that means is if I've got a customer that wants a 5-year term loan for a piece of equipment, I'm going to go out into the market and buy funds or lock away funds for 5 years as well. So there's no interest rate risk to the bank.
Yeah, it mitigates the risk. So in other words,
It does.
so let me ask you this. With companies that are looking for loans, let's just say a $10 million loan, right?
Yeah.
And they need this money for whatever, a building, whatever. Have you seen those companies drop off with their needs as you have volatility with the interest rates? In other words, like, are you seeing less customers now than you did 10 years ago?
No, it stays pretty steady. As interest rates rise, the rise in interest rates that have occurred, with the Fed raising, they're doing that to try and control inflation. Inflation's been high for, the last 4 years. It's been very high. Because of the this is a, and I took a lot of economics. This is an economics thing. So the government printed out so much money, put so much money into the market, that dollar becomes less valuable the more of them you print. And that's why inflation goes up. Well, to cure that, the Feds start to pull that back, by raising the interest rate, and
Yeah.
it tries to slow things down a little bit. Just a side note on that, that does have an effect on the economy. It has effect on housing, people buying houses, but it does tend to keep companies from growing as much as they would if interest rates were lower. But generally, this is a general comment, even within there, people need to buy, or companies need to buy equipment, they need their lines of credit. They just need to make sure that their cash flow is accommodating, their net income cash flow is accommodating to that higher cost of interest rates that they're paying.
Yeah, sure.
When interest rates are low, yeah, business tends to pick up a little bit, especially on the equipment side. But regardless, as I mentioned, companies need to continue to operate whether rates are low or high. And so, as a banker, we just take those transactions, make sure that with the interest rates where they are, that the cash flow still works, and the company can continue to motor on.
Yeah, so it seems like to me our economy has been based off of having to keep the money flowing. One thing that I noticed that the bank started doing, and I was watching this, I was expecting a recession. Everybody was, on the stock side, particularly at the beginning of the last administration. We started seeing more volatility. We started seeing less volume in markets. And started seeing the foreign exchange rate picking up a little bit. I'm not a pro at any of this, but I'm just saying what I noticed over the last 4 or 5 years. But one thing that I noticed that was, in my opinion, something that kept the little guy, I guess you could say, from going under was credit cards. And I saw the credit card debt just absolutely skyrocket. And I was like, well, that makes perfect sense because I started seeing something the banks were offering that I've never seen before, and that was 18-month zero interest credit cards. I'd never seen that before in my life. I have an 800 credit score. I probably got 30 of those things offered a week in my mailbox. I was like, y'all have cut down a whole forest for sending me credit card offers, guys. So let me ask you some general comments about the economy. I know that we started this off with Appalachian poverty, but being a corporate finance guy, I just can't help myself.
Please.
What is your opinion on the national debt? I guess that's a very broad statement. Do you think it's going to continue rising? Do you think I'll just let you have the floor. Tell me what you
It's
think.
it's the national debt, which is all of the debt. When you hear the term national debt, I think it's around 36, $37 trillion. So high that the brain can't comprehend that. That's a number that's crazy. But that is the amount of debt that's been built up since the founding of the nation, clear up to today. Most of it within the past, what, 10 years or so, it's gone up a lot. The issue with the national debt is the interest payments that the government has to make on that. So I think this year we will hit $1 trillion on just interest alone that the government has to pay. So it's concerning because that can't continue. Your question is it going to continue to rise? Well, it in the short term, yeah, but it whether you think it is or not, it can't go up as it's gone up because the country can't sustain that. More money will go into the interest payments than any other program in the coming generation if nothing changes. So you think about $1 trillion, it's just reached that. I think it either reached it last year or it'll be this year. It's $1 trillion just interest alone, doesn't pay down anything. That money could be used for other things. It's kind of in economic terms and finance terms is called the crowding out effect. It crowds out other spending that could have taken place, but it's got to go to interest. So then you get to the to tie to your question is, will it go up? Well, the deficit, which is the annual shortfall of spending, we have more spending than income. That difference is called the deficit, gets added on to the national debt. So it's supposed to rise a couple trillion this year. We keep talking about trillion. That can't happen. What happens, tying a few things together, is the more government spends, the higher inflation is, as I mentioned before. And the only way you're going to get inflation down is if you have government become as efficient as possible and get rid of every dime of waste in the government and modify programs, not talking Social Security or Medicare or whatever, except there's so much waste in there, but making sure people get the benefits that they have. But there's so much waste in government, you got to scrub that down to its basic level. And because otherwise it's going to become so out of control in the future that out of control is the answer. If there's not as many options if it continues to go on. So that's why right now I've said this for 25 years, the government just needs to audit itself. Make sure that you look at every department within the federal government and look at the spending. Where does it go? Is it needed? And audit so there are no mistakes. There's not fraud in there. And finally, that's being done. And I get audit, the feds come into the bank, the FDIC, I get audited once every 18 months or 2 years or whatever the schedule is. And all banks get audited and they send teams in. And they look at everything. And the companies that I work with, they have to get audited by CPA firms. And so everybody gets audited except for the federal government. So this is long overdue to try and get control, or at least a better understanding of the issues in the budget.
So what is the opinion of like your peers, like the other people in the banking world? Are they really scared about the way our country's going in relation to deficits and debt, or are they optimistic with the new administration?
It's, I think it's across the board, really. I don't, there's not, I don't think scared is the word, the factor in finance is just keeping an eye on the economy in general. Like all banks, not just mine, but all banks, we have a monthly meeting on the economy, interest rates. We make sure the interest rate at, we're not taking on interest rate risk needlessly, that we're running the bank from that standpoint. But it ties in directly to the economy and the budget and everything because we watch it. We have to watch it. And as long as we are proactive, any bank is proactive in looking at the economy and understanding interest rates, you can kind of deal with it. Where it gets out of control and the nervousness kicks in is if they don't do anything and it just can't go the way it's gone. So there, for me at least, I can't speak for all bankers, for me at least, having an audit of the feds to make sure that all of the fraud and the waste, which there is so much of in the government, is looked at and dealt with. As long as we're on that and people are watching that in the federal government, it does give comfort, as opposed to let's just print money and just keep sending it out and sending it out, and our interest rates keep going up.
So I'm going to ask you a couple last questions, and then I'll give you the floor towards the end
Sure.
to talk about your book, where to buy it, etc.
Yeah, I just love, I worked with the president of the bank at a couple of other banks that I've worked with, and he called me about, oh, it's been about a year and a half ago, and said, hey, I need you to come. I was doing, this is the part where I was just being a consultant doing my own thing, And he called me, and he's a great guy. And he said, let's build this bank up. And I said, great, I'm in. And I'm glad I did. I'm getting a little older, and so I joke with my wife that I think I'll be working until like I'm 95. I'll come home for lunch, eat some tomato soup or something, and then die right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't plan on retiring anytime soon. I just love what I do. I love people. I've gotten, over the years, my confidence went from nothing to kind of really high. So I love talking to strangers. I like talking to companies. It's just the satisfaction I get from helping companies achieve their goals, maybe solve some problems, and building up my team. So my team has younger lenders in it. And I don't want to retire without passing along all the 36 years of experience I have. And I have training sessions with them. I get joy out of that. And so no, I don't, I love where I work. I'm going to be at this bank until I retire, which again might be when I'm 95. Don't
What
know.
kind of educational background are you looking for with the people who work for you?
It's a good question. So there are two paths. One, the first path, which is the traditional path, is somebody new. So educational background would be somebody with a business degree. It could be in accounting, it could be in economics, it could be in finance, that gets their bachelor's degree. It could be somebody that majored in biology, but then went on to get their master's in business administration. That's great too. So we take those, we would hire those people out of college, and then I start training them, and we give them experience, and over the time they develop the skills to be able to do the job. The other path, and I have one of my people that reports me, is a great guy. He started out as a teller at a little bank, and he doesn't have a college degree, but he just kept being interested in banking, and he just kept working up, working up, working up. And now he's a very good underwriter of mine, knows accounting, knows finance, but doesn't have a bachelor's degree. That's the harder path that I mentioned, but it is a path, but it takes a lot longer to get where you want to be, as opposed to, starting out with the knowledge of accounting and finance from a college degree.
So what is the starting salaries of, let's just make a hypothetical. You're looking for someone out of high or out of college. They have a business degree in finance. What is the starting salary for something like that?
It does vary by geography around the country.
Yeah, sure.
West Virginia might be a little lower than would be than California, right? But I'll say generally, somebody new coming out of college with the proper degree, probably, I'm guessing, in the maybe the $65,000 to $70,000 range. And then that, as your skill set grows, that salary grows each year.
Yeah, sure. I got one more question as it relates to
Sure.
stocks, and then I'll give you well, maybe not stocks, but companies, and then I'll give you the floor for your book. I was looking at a company everyone knows, Ford Motor Company. Oops, sorry. Yeah, so Ford Motor Company, right? And something that I've never really been able to understand is I'm looking at that company and they're billions of dollars in debt. And of course, they got cash flow, right? But does the bank ever just look at these guys and just say, we just can't, there's way too much long-term risk here. We just can't. We gotta, cut off the money.
Yeah, it's when you're talking about these very large companies, and you're using Ford as an example, there are I wouldn't lend to Ford because the bank I work for is very small compared to the
Lenders.
Chase. Yeah, the Chase banks and the JP Morgan or JP Morgan Chase and maybe Comerica and KeyBank and some of these others that deal may deal directly with them. So no matter the size, like a Ford or even a smaller company, every single company is analyzed every year, at least every year. Smaller companies, it's probably quarterly, but big companies like a Ford, they have publicly published financial statements, all the commentaries in there. It's SEC regulated for public companies. And so as a person that even the novice investor, you can get in there and look. If you're not in accounting, if you're trying, if some of that stuff doesn't make sense, accounting and finance, they have, there are analysts that track those companies that, analysts at hedge funds and equity funds and things like that give ratings to the company, like S&P ratings, Moody's ratings, and things like that. So every company is evaluated. Are they performing well? Even if they have a lot of debt, companies can have a lot of debt and still perform well. So you get in there and you look at and you read the analysts, you look at the rate, the published ratings of those companies, and you'll get a lot of insight as to the health of that company. Banks do the same thing. They'll look at the company. If I'm a big bank like JP Morgan Chase, I look into Ford and go through the normal process of analyzing their financial statements, their outlook, their cash flow. They'll probably make a trip to Ford headquarters, talk to the CEO and the CFO of the company, just to get an overall assessment of the health of Ford and any other company like that. But it's very proactive. So if there was a problem brewing, that brewing problem will be identified early on so that you can track it. Did it get worse the next quarter and the next quarter and so on? Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, so you're basically looking and giving it a rating as to the long-term risk of that loan compared to what you know today. But consumer trends may change. And then that would make calls for a reevaluation from a banking standpoint.
That's right. Like electric vehicles, in the case of the, I call them the, the big three. If you're talking about the US auto manufacturers, Ford, Chrysler, and GM, electric vehicles were the hot thing, putting a lot of money into it. They were putting a lot of money. Now that's cooled off a little bit. And so always evaluate what does that do to the company in its outlook. These analysts will pin that down for you if you get online and look. The ratings always provide, here's the company now, but it also encompasses the outlook of the company. So if by chance one of the automakers is not reacting quick enough to this change in market, that will hurt them and that will show up in the ratings and in the analysis.
That's really interesting. I never knew that. So you guys from a banking standpoint are looking at it and saying, are you keeping up with consumer trends to have a positive outlook on sales?
Yeah, even companies that, let me give you an example. Companies that I deal with occasionally might be a smaller auto parts manufacturer that's selling parts to Ford or GM or Chrysler or Honda or whoever. We analyze that, and because Ford is or one of the big three or auto manufacturers is a large customer of my customer, we watch that as well. If the company that I'm dealing with is only making electric vehicle parts, we look at that and say, ah, we got to call a timeout here and make sure we've got our arms around where the electric vehicle market is going. And is there going to be a disruption from like Ford reducing its parts demand for electric vehicles, that's going to affect my smaller company that I deal with. So it's like this chain reaction. So I have to look at that on those other companies.
So you're looking at the risk even, are you, I'm assuming you're even looking at the risk from a supply chain standpoint, like, oh, okay.
It's absolutely true. We had, during the pandemic, there were a lot of supply chain issues. Customers had the orders, companies that I dealt with had orders, but they couldn't get the material in. They couldn't get it. If they were bringing it in from offshore, that was a big issue. And so we had to look at that and still do look at that because even though I have orders or the company has orders, but they can't fulfill them, that's not a good situation for a company. They're going to lose money if they can't get that reconciled and fixed.
Yep. I never realized just how thorough these corporate loans are, but it makes total sense. That's really awesome. So one last question here, and then I'll give you the floor for your book. How do you think that AI is going to affect your industry, the banking industry? Do you think accounting is going to get automated, to some extent, et cetera?
Yeah, I can speak for, like the banking industry is looking at this heavily, AI, and using it for as much as possible administration within the group. And I'll give you a good example. When a company sends their financial statements in, let's say they want a loan for something, they'll send all their past financials and current financial statements in. One thing that a bank always does, it's called spreading. We will spread those financial statements. What that means is a bank will put them, hand code those statements into a software package that calculates ratios and things like that. But it's always been a manual calculation or a manual input, if you will, into a software. So you're reading the hard financial statements you have, and you're putting that data into a software package by hand because all financial statements are different, now AI is getting close, and this has been I remember as a young lender saying, whoever cracks this code that these statements can be read and automatically spread is going to be a billionaire, but nobody's ever been able to crack the code until now. They're getting very close to that. We're actually testing some software at the bank that I'm at that claims to be able to you scan that statement in, and then it AI reads it and then puts it in the right software format. So we're going to try that. But if that's successful, what that does is it allows me to grow without hiring as many staff that I would have had to hire. So we keep our staff the way it is now, but it allows us to be more efficient and do more because we're not doing so much grunt typing work, putting the stuff into a software. It's going to be done automatically. So that's one example. I think big banks are all over it. They have a lot of money and research departments, but any bank, no matter if it's small or large, they're looking in how can AI help the bank become more efficient.
Yeah. And it seems like to me that over the next few years with AI, especially from a financial standpoint, that how that's going to affect the jobs is the managerial aspect. The relationships that they have are going to be way more important because there's going to be
It's
less of them.
right. It's exactly right. As I mentioned before, it all come banking and any business, I think, whether you go to the grocery store or whatever, it's person to person. How do you treat that person? Build the relationship so they know who you are, you know who they are, and you can react and help them proactively. Those relationships will never go away. It's going to be how efficient the back office becomes to allow me more time to be that relationship to that company.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Mr. Ackley, I really appreciate you being on. And it ran long. Honestly, we're at like a little over an hour and a half. So, couple things here. Number one, let us know where we can get your book, the book name, where we
Oh
can
yeah.
purchase it, etc.
Yeah, so I really appreciate that. I did write a book about everything we talked about because we just talked about high finance and accounting and relationships with bankers and things. For me, I'm a poor kid from Appalachia that learned a lot of lessons during that time that have allowed me to become successful today with my family personally and in my business. Everything I do goes back to growing up with adversity, understanding the hardships of people. And so we talk all this high finance, but I'm the poor kid from Appalachia, and I so much appreciate that experience. So I did write a book about how did I get from there to here? And let me show it to you. It's a book called Searching for Change. You can get it on Amazon. You can just type, you can just do a search, Searching for Change, put my last name on there. It'll pop up. It is also on audio. So if you don't like to read a hardcover, hard book, you can listen to it. I meant, as I said, I really meant it to be originally just for my kids and my grandkids, just to know something about how I grew up and the lessons that I learned. But I talked to business people over, the course of years, and they said, "You really ought to publish something about this." So I said, "Okay." And so it's getting 5-star ratings, which I'm appreciative of, so that's my lesson from my book that hopefully people get something out of it.
Yeah, awesome. And for the listeners, I hope that you guys give his book a chance. And obviously, Amazon is a great place to buy, a very safe place to buy. That's my big
Yeah.
thing. So for me personally, I actually have a habit of this. So I have an enormous amount of books, and I love reading. And for whatever reason, getting into podcast world, a lot of people have books. So what I would like to do is find, for me personally, a place where I can purchase this book, but I would like to have a signed copy.
Oh yeah, every book that's ordered for me, every 100% I sign.
Really? So if I
Oh,
put a picture
every
on
book.
one, awesome. So I'm gonna get over there and I'm gonna purchase one on
Yeah.
Amazon, and I'll be looking for that because like I said, it's just become a good habit and it's awesome. So one last question I ask everyone. Don't be afraid to tell me my faults. 'Cause I'm new at this. So how would you rate how I did as a fellow? I almost look at myself almost like your guest, really. But how did I do as far as the podcast goes?
I think it was wonderful. This is a topic, Randy, that needs to be discussed more. Going from poverty and rising above it and being successful in life, there's too much of our society that's still in that rut, as I used to call it. I'm in this big rut and I don't know how to get out of it. It's discussions, for example, you mentioned Ruby Payne. It's Randy Atwell, it's Jan Ackley, discussing this and helping people, which is my goal with doing these types of things. I was in that spot, and I was so lucky to have certain people mentor me to get my way of thinking different, to be able to be successful. And I want to be that person for somebody that's stuck in the rut. And so that's my opinion of how you did. You hit every topic that I would have wanted you to hit. We talked about everything, and I just think it's a wonderful experience for people to see this.
Awesome. And I may follow up an email and try to get you on again.
Oh,
There's a
please.
couple things that that I really like talking about that we didn't necessarily have time, but I do want to give two people a shout out that was not a part of this, but without those people, in my opinion, This would not have been possible. And that's mine and your wives or
Oh,
wives.
yeah.
A man has
It's
never been successful without a positive woman in the background. And
it,
they hold us all together.
I say this as often as people will listen to me. My wife has been an example. You know, I mentioned her father, my father-in-law. She has been as much of an example to me as anybody in my life to help me raise my bar. She took a chance on a poor kid. A very poor kid. We lived in different worlds, and she still went out with me and still had confidence in me. And without her, none of what I've been able to do in life would be possible.
Yeah. Shout out to our wives. What's your wife's first
Yeah.
name?
Deanne.
Deanne.
Deanne. Deanne.
Awesome. Awesome. And my wife's name is Autumn. So shout out to Autumn and Deanne.
Yep.
And we appreciate them women in our life.
Yeah.
Mr. Ackley, I appreciate you. I will follow up an email and I'm going to literally buy that book here in just like half an hour. So
Good. You'll get a signed copy.
awesome. Thank you, sir. You have a great day.
Thanks. See ya.